I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. We're going team by team. I would be very careful about slinging stuff. Am I going to get sued?
Are we legal on this?
I like football. I like football season. All the things that go with it.
All right, welcome into today's PFF NFL podcast. We're live again, day three?
Day three.
Of the Combine here at Radio Row, or whatever we're calling Radio Row in the Combine. It's a grind, Bradley. It's day three.
It's a grind.
There's a lot of days to go.
Knees are weak, feet are, you know, we're here though.
Sam Monson, Brad Spielberger. We're going to have a bit of a montage show. We're going to have Trevor Sikkema up later. Mike Renner's going to join us as well. And we're going to give you a little bit of an update of everything that's been happening Combine Week, including do we tell people about the 40 time?
I mean, you want to get to it because you were the winner of the group we're here, which is a low bar.
No. It's not a good thing.
Bless the people. It's not bad.
Look, there's a certain element of being like, you know, this is not a high bar to clear to be the fastest of the group that ran.
Correct.
We went to the NFL Combine experience, such as it was, and we ran 40 times. And I ran a 5.33 in jeans, which is pretty embarrassing.
He is wearing jeans. I can attest to that. Yeah. This is classic like content we're creating for the commenters of like, yeah, like the fastest guy at PFF runs a 5.33.
Yeah.
It happened.
That was bad. Now, it was only a tenth off what Renner ran when he said he could run a 4.6. So there is that.
I mean,
even worse.
Yep, and it's not the infamous Seth Galina broad jump. You know, that was dark times. So.
That's bad. And it wasn't the Gordon McGinnis 6.8. So
no comment.
There's always a lower bar. That's the point. Anyway, so we've done a little bit of the Combine experience, but first, Brad is more on the kind of free agent side of things. This week of the Combine, obviously you've got the guys doing the workouts, you've got all the draft stuff that everybody's focused on, but in the background, percolating away is free agency, and trades, and agents, and all that kind of stuff that theoretically is tampering, but happens in the background of, you know, all of this stuff and starts that whole process going. So that's your kind of area of specialty, and that's what we're going to talk about first once we tell everybody about Western and Southern. We're not in the Western and Southern studio, but the Western and Southern studio comes to us here in Indianapolis. The PFF NFL podcast is sponsored by Western and Southern Financial Group. While you focus on your roster moves, Western and Southern helps you advance your money moves. Buying your first home, planning to start a family, wondering how to make your money grow, Western Southern's playbook of life insurance, investment, and retirement solutions helps you rest assured on game day. Team up to understand needs and address goals with a game plan built just for you. Get started at westernsouthern.com/PFF. westernsouthern.com/PFF. All right, Brad. So what are you hearing? What's the buzz so far?
Yeah, I mean, a couple guys that are going to do very, very well. Not that it's a surprise, but you never know. First, Javon Hargrave, Philadelphia Eagles interior defender, coming off a great season. First double-digit sack season of his career. So some of those flashy numbers on top of, obviously, you know, top three PFF pass rush grade behind Aaron Donald and Chris Jones. Always good company to keep. Is a guy that's looking at maybe even approaching, sniffing a $20 million per year contract. I don't think it'll get there, but if he makes it out of Philadelphia, with Deron Payne getting the franchise tag, with all these 2019 draft class guys coming up, Quinnen Williams, Jeffrey Simmons, Dexter Lawrence, he is going to get a very sizable contract.
He's had an incredible last couple of seasons. I mean, the last 2 years, we have back-to-back seasons with a PFF pass rushing grade above 91. 91.1 this past season, 91.6 the year before that. 60-plus pressures in each one of those years, if you include the playoffs. The year before that, his first one in Philadelphia was good, not great as a pass rusher, but three pretty spectacular seasons when you take them in their totality of pure pass rushing. What was strange, though, is that they coincided with 3 years where his run defense just kind of evaporated. I mean, he was like a nose tackle, really, for the Steelers.
Yeah.
Before he signed Philadelphia, they used him more as this pass rushing role, and it meant that got incredible rush out of him, but at the expense of any run defense whatsoever. And it's like, A, they never cared, and B, nobody else does either. As long as he can rush the passer and put up, you know, elite production numbers, we can deal with run defense elsewhere.
100% right. I mean, the Pittsburgh thing is interesting. You have Cam Hayward, Stephon Tuitt in the fold, both, I mean, special players when they were in their prime. So, you know, he's kind of coming up beneath those guys. Maybe he was able to get on the field by playing more 0-1. But, yeah, as a one-gapping, you know, get up the field, pass rush guy, he is as good as it gets right now.
So who else are you hearing is likely to get a big bag this free agent? Period, you know, we were talking about it. It's not a great class, but there's a lot of money to spend.
Yeah, and a guy that fits the classic mold of a guy that's going to get a huge contract in free agency is Tremaine Edmonds of the Buffalo Bills. Linebacker for them, off-ball linebacker. I mentioned this in a recent article, how you can't really franchise tag these guys because the linebacker tag is outside linebacking edge rushers as well as off-ball linebackers. So the Bills are not going to put a $21 million tag on Tremaine Edmonds, but he might get $18, $19, $20 million per year. Look, going to be 25 in his sixth NFL season next year for the first couple months. You know, freakishly athletic. Obviously, we know all those things. And we saw this year, his best year in coverage by a mile. Starting to recognize things, identify things. But, yeah, Matt Milano's in Buffalo, so they're not going to pay more money there. And I think a lot of teams are going to be in the mix.
Yeah, we talked about this earlier when we were just on the floor here, that there's too many boxes that he ticks for him to not get, you know, a giant contract. He's got the size, the athleticism, the prototypical tools that you're looking for the position. He's still insanely young. He's coming off his best year, a career year where he did have a genuinely elite season, and in particular was great in coverage, which obviously is the most important area in today's NFL. Like, this is a guy designed to get a ton of money in free agency. The only concern is this was a giant kind of outlier in terms of the rest of his career. But even then, because of the first round draft pick, in part because of the flashy plays, I think his perception was always a little bit higher than what we were grading him the last few years. So if you are into the kind of confirmation bias of Tremaine Edmonds, you were already believing he was a great player, and then this season only reinforced everything you thought.
Right, and he already was still racking up, you know, the volume stats and whatnot, but, you know, does not miss many games at all. Missed a couple games this year, I want to say, but generally does not miss many snaps. You know, sideline to sideline, I think he's top 10 in defensive stops among off-ball linebackers since he started his career 5 years ago. So, you know, at the very least, you're getting a guy who's going to be productive, clean some things up on the back end if necessary.
We talked before, I think when we did the free agent preview show, about, you know, off-the-ball linebackers become this weird position where maybe its value is different depending on where you are in a kind of roster construction standpoint, right? If you're the Bears and you had no help around Roquan Smith, it didn't make any sense to pay him. You get rid of him because he can't fix it on his own. He's already there and he's not fixing it. But if you're Baltimore and you already have a pretty good defense, everything's already in place, you can actually pay Roquan Smith a decent amount of money because he does make a material difference to that defense. He can put it over the top because it's already pretty good. Are there enough teams that are good enough that it makes sense for them to commit a giant sum of money to Tremaine Edmonds, or are those teams that are in the mix beyond, you know, the ones that do fit that category, are they just sort of not really appreciating that, and it's potentially folly to throw $20 million at him?
No, it's an interesting point. Obviously, Fred Warner as well, special player. But, you know, in San Fran, if they didn't have that amazing defensive line, maybe, like, again, he can't make that much of an impact that he does make now. I'll tell you this. Can't say who it is, but a team that is a competitive team is definitely in the mix there. And I think some non-competitive teams that are willing to spend a little bit, maybe bring in kind of a foundational piece to build around, are also in that market as well.
Because he strikes me as one of those classically risky free agent signings. Like, there's definitely a payoff to be had. There's definitely an elite playmaker there. We saw that this year, but I think situation for him is key, you know, and I don't know if his representatives or he personally is sort of thinking about things that way, or is just, look, I'm going where the biggest deal is, or whatever. I think, but, like, I think his side of this would be smart to pay attention to what the situation is when he's deciding, like, where he's going to end up.
I think he'd be better in a 4-3, you know, if they try to target that potentially. But, yeah, it is important. Like you said, there's the buyer beware potential for him for sure, but someone's going to do it.
All right, what else are we hearing?
One more name is Draymond Jones, the Denver Broncos. I know it's been interesting now to hear George Payton, general manager, kind of say, we're trying to work through that, we're trying to get a deal done. They had all season to go through that. You know, obviously have not gotten to that point yet. Still time before March 13th. But another guy that, if you're looking for an odd front, 3-4, you know, kind of 3-4 defensive end type player, very, very good pass rusher. Again, a little bit deficient as a run defender, but that's not what gets you paid, right? Paid as you're getting after the quarterback, and he is very, very good in that area.
Yeah, he was one of these people that we didn't talk an awful lot when we were doing our, you know, fixing the teams in 5 minutes series in the podcast, but he actually does make a lot of sense for quite a number of teams in the NFL. And it's a guy that should be getting interest.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, if you're trying to, and well, with some of the news coming out today with the draft as well, though, I think if you're looking for a guy that can generate pass rush from the interior, those guys don't really hit free agency that often. And so maybe, again, yeah, there is some potential there, but I think he's going to land somewhere that will make the most of what he's doing, and it'll be a good fit.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming up later in the show, we are going to be diving into the chaos that's been the news story surrounding Jalen Carter, the defensive lineman from Georgia. We're going to talk to Mike Renner about that. And try and make sense of exactly what's going on. One more name it's worth bringing up, Saquon Barkley. Obviously, arguably one of the sort of the best talents available in this entire draft, but he's a running back. So we've got this classic, emblematic, now where are we in the running back market? Are the Giants going to figure out a way of keeping him around? Do they even want to keep Saquon Barkley around given the kind of cost that it would take? And if and when he makes the open market, what is that going to look like for a guy like him, given the abundance of running backs available this offseason, whether it's free agency or the draft?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I think Joe Shane has been more outspoken as a general manager about how much he cares about positional value. I know we obviously had another general manager on the show recently who didn't really buy into positional value a ton, but he said that many times. Like, we don't really view that as a foundational piece, as a piece to build around a team around. So I think that's interesting. Depends on who you talk to. That's, oh, they're going to get it done. Some people say there's no way he's going to hit the open market. They can't get it. Look, they have one franchise tag. The deadline is March 7th. And if they negotiate a nine-figure deal with Daniel Jones in the next week, then, yeah, they can tag Saquon Barkley a $10.1 million. But can they get that deal done with Daniel Jones? It seems like a difficult thing to do in that short of time.
Yeah, I mean, that feels unlikely given where those two sides are likely to be in those negotiations. I mean, there has to be a fairly wide starting gap anyway, and it's going to be quite a challenge to close that by the time the deadline rolls around.
We also switched representation, you know, about a week ago. So, you know, this new group is basically starting at square one. And maybe to a degree, there's, you know, pick up some momentum. But, yeah, seems unlikely. But, again, like, depending on who you talk to, some people think it is possible.
Is that as obvious a sign as it seems that, like, okay, the first group wasn't getting me the kind of deal that I'm looking for. I'm going to this other group. They're going to get me more money.
I haven't heard anything about it, you know.
But logically, that's all it can be, right?
That's probably the most logical thing you would assume. You know, it could also be other things as well. I mean, I think we do sometimes forget that these agents are negotiating. Look, I live in New York. I haven't seen Daniel Jones on many billboards and many commercials. He is the franchise quarterback. Like, could be that too, for all we know.
Yeah. He doesn't really have a face for billboards. You know what I mean? It's not a – it doesn't feel like he has a commercial type of visage.
He's not, I guess, like a New York market guy, right? He's not very, you know, not a lot of flash.
Though,
but,
I guess,
you know,
to be fair, neither was Eli Manning, you know, and that worked out all right.
Exactly right.
For a decent period of time there. Though he did, you know, bring two Super Bowl rings. That's going to help.
That certainly helps. Yep, getting the jokes out, being Arch Manning's son, also helps. Or Archie
also
Manning.
Also true. Yeah,
him,
yeah.
Not his nephew's son. Yeah, so, you know, that helps as well.
All right, so anything else we're hearing so far from this week?
And I would say this, like, I don't think there's going to be a ton of franchise tags. So we talked about this on the show a couple weeks ago where, look, it's not the greatest class, but the guys are actually going to make it to the market, right? So obviously the first one came down with De'Ron Payne. You know, maybe you'll see one or two of the tackles, maybe a Juwan Taylor in Jacksonville, maybe a Caleb McGarry, Mike McGlinchey, but I would still bet, you know, that's not the case.
Juwan Taylor's an interesting guy, though, because we were talking before about the Jags' offensive line was the strangest offensive line in the NFL last year. It was the most one-dimensional unit in the league in terms of, it was pretty good as a pass blocking group. Across the board, those guys all graded well. As a collective, they graded well, but it was the worst run blocking offensive line in the league. It had the lowest grade, basically start to finish, in the entire NFL season. And Juwan Taylor, as a second round guy, you know, again, in the Tremaine Edmonds mold of 25 years old, hitting free agency at the optimal time, a guy with the tools, you know, all those kinds of things, and has been better as a pass blocker than a run blocker for his entire career, which, again, like Javon Hargrave, it's the area we care about now. Yeah. And maybe he isn't a great run blocker. In fact, his run blocking grade has gotten worse two of the last 3 years. He's gone from 61 to 43 to 37, or to 39, rather. The pass blocking has been consistently good.
Very interesting. So I actually asked Jaguars general manager Trent Baalke at his podium, you know, does the presence of Walker Little, a guy you drafted, a second-round pick who played very well last year, he got about 300 snaps when Cam Robinson got hurt, does the presence of him, you know, being a good young player, maybe make it easier to move on from a Juwan Taylor? Wouldn't directly answer that question, but I will tell you this. I talked to multiple clubs that think Juwan Taylor is a elite pass blocker and could get a, like you said, that's what you pay for. I think he could be one of these surprise deals of the offseason where fans are saying, why is this deal so big? And teams are saying, we're not surprised at all.
I do feel like elite is stretching it a little. I understand those aren't your words. Those are being relayed from other people. I wouldn't go that far. I can see good, and I think good is valuable and worth paying for, but elite feels like a stretch.
There could be some projection there, and you mentioned 25 years old, Mike McGlinchey and Caleb McGarry are 28. So like a big gap there in the development potential, I mean, where he could go in a new building.
And certainly a guy like Caleb McGarry is the other end of the spectrum in terms of great run blocker this past season. Pass blocking was still a relative weakness. Like if that's the area of the game you care about, if you're like, we need to solidify pass protection on this offensive line, you're going to skew towards Taylor and away from a guy like McGarry. Like, you're almost not comparable players.
And you hear that, too. You definitely hear, like, McGlinchey and McGarry have to go to these wide zone teams that, you know, use them in space, want to get them. And then, yeah, Taylor the opposite. Like, you want him to be, you know, in pass protection and not really trying to get to the second level and make plays up there. So, but, hey, there's teams need both of those things. I would guess, you know, how many teams are now running this wide zone system that does favor those guys? Right. But, I mean, 28, 29 as your first veteran contract is pretty old.
So the other thing I want to ask you is, this is, you know, a week where a lot of NFL personnel are speaking publicly in front of podiums and in interviews and all these kinds of things, including to us. And people, despite years of evidence to the contrary, tend to treat everything they say as the truth or gospel. You know, this guy said, therefore, you know, this is what's going to happen. You obviously are dealing with a lot of off-the-record conversations and stuff where people can actually be honest as opposed to media face. How much of what you're hearing is directly contrary to the stuff that's coming out publicly? Like, for example, you know, Jason Light saying that Leonard Fournette's got years left at the top, and then, like, 20 minutes later, you cut him.
Future starter Kyle Trask.
Yes.
Yeah, that's all I'll say there. But, yeah, so, yes, they are different conversations. But I will say, I do think the guys, when they get up on the podiums, they try to give you what they can, but you got to keep your cards close to the vest.
Yeah, so, like, so how much of that do you think is them just trying to get through the question without being too committal and, you know, putting anything out there that's a soundbite, and how much of it is, like, deliberately wanting to mislead the media so they don't ask whatever question that's awkward?
Unfortunately, I think it's the former. You know, you see some examples of a guy that maybe says a little bit too much and it creates a whirlwind, and so they just unfortunately then shut down and kind of give you nothing. But I will say, too, some guys, they want to put some misinformation out there, swindle a little bit, you know, get, you know, I mean, Howie Roseman is, you know,
Smokescreen,
he's Super Bowl GM for a reason this past year. You know, he might be one of the best at it in the whole league.
Gotta love the smokescreen. All right, Brad, that's been awesome. We're going to move on now to our next part of this whole segment, but we've still got days left of this. There's still some cool stuff to come, and of course, all the workouts are still on the horizon. Maybe somebody can run faster than my 5.33.
Let's see if someone can beat the 5.33.
I mean, right now, that's the benchmark.
Someone 380 pounds might go slower than you, which I don't know if that counts as a W for you, but you can take it as one.
No, I don't want to know. I don't want DeJuan Jones to run faster than me. I don't want to see it. Look, the one thing you have in your favor when you're normal size is I can outrun the giant guy. He'll kill me if he gets hold of me, but I can outrun him. I can't outrun him, I've got nothing left.
You should have put on some, like, you know, spandex, too, instead of these jeans you're on. Then you would have been, what, 4'8"?
They had the Combine is sponsored by, like, Noble this year or whatever. They had, like, a stall outside with, like, legit, you know, Lycra workout gear. I was like, I can go shave 3 tenths right off this immediately.
Yeah. Didn't want to pull a Chris Jones, which, you know, understand it.
Right. And also, you know, pull a Chris Jones, or the other scary thing would have been pull a hamstring, like, right off the bone.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of concerns. But my point being, right now, that's the benchmark time.
That's the number set. These guys all know it. They're all thinking about it.
I have not seen a faster 40 time this week at the Combine.
No one has.
Hasn't happened.
Fact.
Probably. So that's the time to beat. All right, Brad, thanks very much. We'll see you next time.
Thanks. It sounds good.
All right, joined with Trevor Sickema now. We talked a little bit about free agency and what Brad's been hearing behind the scenes with agents and with NFL teams. You've been working the podiums, though. You've been in there grinding up at the podiums, asking questions, finding out what these NFL GMs, what players have been talking about.
Yep.
What are some of the biggest storylines coming out of that?
So we had defensive line and linebackers today, and, you know, the handful of them stood out. First and foremost, Nolan Smith. And Nolan Smith, he tore his pec, so he wasn't able to finish the season. Edge rusher out of Georgia, former number one overall recruit. And man, he got up to the podium and just had energy the entire time. I mean, the passion that this guy has for the game of football was undeniable throughout that, whatever it was, 10, 12 minutes, however long that he was at the podium. And, you know, he talked about a lot of things. He talked about getting better as a pass rusher. He talked about the work ethic that was instilled with him at the University of Georgia. He talked about the passion that he has for run defense, even as a 6'3", 235-pound edge defender. Right. And so, I mean, I was blown away by, just how passionate he was about getting better, about the game of football and everything. And he's somebody who was a former number one overall recruit who didn't have a ton of production coming out of Georgia, right? There was a long time when he wasn't even really cracking the rotation. He kind of, I don't want to say joked about it, but somebody asked him about that. And he's like, hey, at the end of the day, Georgia has a lot of really good football players. Yeah. Like, I didn't play because I wasn't better. And he's like, and that was something where I went to Georgia and I saw these guys ahead of me producing more than me, producing better than me, and it kind of motivated me to be even better. So I think this guy's best football is going to be ahead of him. He said that he was going to run the 40, jump the vertical, and jump the broad, even with that recovering from that pec injury. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I want to show how much of a worker I am. And so, I don't know, some guys say that, and you go like, all right, yeah. I mean, it could be fake, could be not. I don't doubt it with this guy. I think that he's for real. So he's the guy who definitely stood out to me the most from the podium.
Backing up a little bit, how much of these sort of podium appearances are you actually interested in what they're saying? You know, do they say something interesting? Do they impart a new piece of information that we haven't had? Do they just give you a soundbite that you can use? And how much of it do you feel is like an opportunity to simply get to know those guys a little bit better, kind of like a public version of the interviews the teams are doing with them,
and
right?
And that's kind of what it is, right? And we heard from head coaches and general managers yesterday. The number one thing that everybody asks them is like, oh, you know, what are you looking to see while you're here? And across the board, all of them say, we are here to figure out who these prospects are as people.
Right.
And that's just the number one part of it. Now, they even kind of joke and say, we're meeting with so many prospects here in Indianapolis, it's almost like speed dating, right? They don't have the opportunity to actually get to know them one-on-one for as long as they would like to, but... Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that you can look at podium sessions. You know, you look at how charismatic somebody might be, you know, how confident they are, the answers that they might have to certain questions, whether they're personal questions, whether they're questions about their teammates, whether they're questions about their game, technique, how they've gotten better, all these things. And just, you know, these little interviews should never be seen as the all and all for these players.
Right.
It's certainly not with the teams, right? With the teams, they would say, okay, we liked what we heard and saw from this guy in Indianapolis. Maybe we bring him in for a private visit, one of those top 30 visits, one of those local visits, whatever. So the teams don't even take just what we saw here in Indianapolis as the full scouting report. But it is a little bit of a peer into just how they are, like their personality, and like I said, how they can answer a lot of these questions. So I always love hearing from these players because as someone who scouts these guys on the outside, we can watch all the tape, we can see all the data, but at the end of the day, it is who they are as people that are the real answer to will they achieve what we think they can achieve. And so I always really enjoy that part of it. I try to take little nuggets away from a lot of these guys, especially when they impress me at the podium. So that's kind of how I approach it.
Yeah, and I think you're always going to get a wide spectrum of personalities that can lead to successful or great players. You know, you can be an outspoken, outgoing,
100%,
you know, bubbly
yes.
personality, or you can be the sort of quiet Justin Herbert type of introverted, you know, reserved type of personalities. Those are all fine. Any of those work, right? But I think, like every other aspect of scouting or the pre-draft process, to me, it's like it's another opportunity that something could raise a red flag to at least make you think, right?
Sure.
And all of us have met people where within 5 minutes you're like, hate that guy, hate that guy. And I think most of the time, you're probably right. You picked up on something, right?
Yeah.
And it's best to just not, you know, let's just steer clear of that guy.
Yeah.
Most of them are not going to be that, but.
Right.
Every now and again, you're going to come across a guy and you're like, no, no chance. No way are we drafting that kid.
So I was having a conversation with somebody not too long ago, earlier today, and, you know, they were asking about what this week really is. Is it, you know, are you figuring out things? Are you building out the scouting board? Or are you more eliminating players off of your board?
Yeah.
And I think it is more of the latter, right? Even when you talk about measurables and what you're going to see with the weigh-ins and maybe some of the athletic drills as well, the combine, for as much as people maybe don't see it like this, because on the media we see the fun in it, we see the excitement in it, a lot of these teams this week are probably crossing guys off of their board.
Yeah, 100%.
A lot of them have their board set in February, and then the combine is about how do we narrow that board down is the phrase that you often hear. So I think that's what we're really getting this week.
Yeah, or at the very minimum, If a guy is going to fail a threshold or doesn't tick a box,
yeah,
you need some reason for you not to take that off of the board.
He's got to blow you away in a
right.
different area.
Like,
for
or,
sure.
You know, for example, like if you're a team that has thresholds on 40 times or whatever, right? This guy falls below our threshold. He's not as fast as we want.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's go and check. Let's go back to the tape, figure out if that shows up there. Let's, you know, cross-check with the NGS stuff. Let's see if player tracking data can say that's not his real time. Like, that's not telling us the true story.
Right.
But it's at the very minimum, you're using it as a check system, right? It's
yes.
like, these are guys where we find a red flag. Maybe we're taking them off the board completely, or if we're not, we need a good reason for that to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the measurables are that. The medical, obviously, is that. And these interviews have got to be that. Not necessarily
yep.
the podium stuff, but the private interviews the teams are doing. It's all about, to me, the entire process for drafting is about ticking guys off. Like,
yep.
not on the board anymore, not on the board anymore, fails here, fails there.
That's how we get the Patriots with, like, 12 total players
yeah, yeah.
on their draft
and
board.
That's, we have, we have a list of 15 players, and that's all. That's our draft board. And that's what we're drafting.
That's how Cole Strange becomes a number one, or not a number one overall, but a
first-round
draft pick.
Yeah,
right?
absolutely.
Right.
And it has
right.
the Rams breaking their ass laughing at the fact they thought he'd be available in the third. All right, who else said anything that raised your interest?
A handful of guys that I like today. I really like Felix Onodike-Uzomah from Kansas State, the pass rusher there. I thought that he was a fringe first-round prospect going into this, and just a lot of the ways that he answered questions, especially, you know, look, you know how it goes. Media has evolved where there's so many different media people here, and some of the questions that can go viral, if you will, or shared a lot, is when you can get, like, technique answers out of these players. Like,
right.
oh, what's your go-to pass rush move? How have you improved as a pass rush? Whatever. And Felix got a lot of those questions, and I thought that he just answered them in such a detailed way that showed, like, okay, I'm not just going to tell you the names of pass rush moves. I'm not just going to tell you a long arm, a club rip, a cross chop, or whatever. I'm going to tell you why they worked. And he walked us through, I think he was talking about the profile of how you start a game and how you really get a game plan for somebody. And he's like, look, first thing I do against offensive tackles is I got decently long arms and I got some power to me. So I'm going to long arm them at the beginning of the game, and I'm going to figure out how good their balance is. I'm going to figure out how strong they are. I'm going to figure out how well they can anchor and say, okay, is this a player that I can manipulate with one hand, or am I going to have to put my full body into it in order to move this guy? From there, he said, then you build out a game plan to have moves and counters and everything. And it's like, this guy doesn't just understand the moves. He understands the why.
Yeah.
Which is what's really important. And so he also definitely stood out to me in a big way.
That's very cool. Yeah, the actual sort of, you don't hear a lot about that from players generally, of what is your game plan to go in and figure out where you can beat a guy. Because
mm-hmm.
it's obvious once you actually do strike upon it that, hey, this is how I'm going to win, and
right.
spend the rest of the game doing that.
Right.
But you don't hear a lot of players talk about how they arrive at that conclusion at all, whether it's film study, whether it's the initial, you know, 10 plays of the game, like your offensive script,
mm-hmm.
you run a defensive pass rushing script, and you almost never get like a peek behind that curtain.
No, but it was more detailed than I felt like I've gotten, not just this year, but over the years throughout the combine. So I was super impressed with that. I will also say that Gervin Dexter, the defensive lineman from Florida, one, I thought that he was great. I thought he answered all sorts of questions about becoming a better pass rusher and what he brings to the game. And there was a little nugget in there where he mentioned that he played basketball. And then he also mentioned that Anthony Richardson, the quarterback at Florida,
mm-hmm.
he played AAU basketball with Richardson. And so I asked him a little bit more about that. I was like, okay, what position did you play? And he's like, I played power forward. And I was like, what position did Anthony play? He's like, Anthony could play any position. He's like, Anthony played 1 through 5 for us on our AAU teams whenever we played. And he was raving about just how versatile athletic Anthony Richardson is. He said that Anthony Richardson could have won the NBA slam dunk contest if he was in it this year. And there's a couple of clips of him absolutely throwing down if anybody out there has not watched them yet. And so for him to just rave again, I know saying that Anthony Richardson's a great athlete isn't breaking news on the
right.
show or anything, but just kind of more evidence to this is a true, natural, explosive, high-ceiling athlete who's been able to do it on multiple sports, I thought was very interesting.
The other thing that was fascinating was a guy that wasn't at the podium. Obviously, Jalen Carter.
Of course.
After what
yep.
The news that broke this morning, was almost 0% chance he was ever going to appear at the podium
no.
once that break
no.
broke, particularly because there was enough time between the news breaking and
yeah.
him going up there that, you know, enough people could get on the phone and say, no, not
right,
happening.
Right.
If it had been 5 minutes before he was going up, maybe it would have been a different story. But we did have the farce of, you know, 100 people crowded around the empty podium that he was supposed to be at just on the off chance.
Yeah.
They were, you know, careless enough to let him go out there and field questions after all that.
Well, this is player one for a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
This is Jalen Carter's number one on players' boards. And, you know, with a warrant out for his arrest, I don't even know what's going to happen legally with him, let alone what his draft stock is, where he could possibly go. It's way too early to predict what teams are going to think of this. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that have to play out with Jalen Carter, but there's no doubt about it. It's a huge shakeup. You know, somebody who I was talking to earlier today after the news broke was like, this feels like Laramie Tunsil, right? Where it's a situation where, of course, it's not on draft night, but that video came out of Tunsil, and the only answer to the question of what happens now is, I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I mean, it's you're right. The huge difference here, other than the fact that, you know, we're talking about dramatically different incidents, consequences,
and
all
events,
those kinds of
yeah.
things. Right, exactly.
Yes.
The one big difference other than that is timing. Like, it's not Laramie Tunsil
right.
just before the draft.
Right.
It's not Lyle Collins on draft day either, where, you know, that became, what do we do about this? No
yeah.
clue.
Right.
This is going to have some time to work its way out, and teams are going to be able to figure out what they think of this over
yep.
the next couple of months and,
yep.
and readjust there. We'll get into it more with Mike Renner later in this podcast and talk it through. But that was... like, that was really the story of today. Like, this was the biggest news of today. It was the thing that everybody was talking about within this room. It's, you know, it affected obviously the podium appearance of him, but it affected everybody else's podium appearance as well.
Yep.
Everybody crowding around trying to figure out what to do about this. This was a weird, random event to be thrown into the middle of this thing like a grenade.
Agreed. It was a wild scene. It was something that was, as news was breaking and as people were trying to figure it out, nobody knew it was going to happen. I don't even know if Carter's still here. I don't know if this is something that they got wind of early. I don't even know if he's still in Indianapolis. I don't know what's going to happen after this. But there's no doubt about it that the big talk is, of course, going to be what happens with him, because that's how the rest of the draft's going to go.
What about on the NFL personnel side of things? We've had some head coaches. We've had some GMs talk at the podiums. Have
yeah.
you heard anything interesting from those guys who – let's be honest, don't always tell the truth around this time of year?
No, and you know, GMs and head coaches are very good at this. Like, they don't want to give away too much. But I was at two podiums specifically that are off the top of my head that I had some takeaways from. First one is Terry Fontenot, the general manager from the Atlanta Falcons. They have the number 8 overall pick. A couple of things I learned, and one of them is how important the nickel cornerback position is to Terry Fontenot. He called it a consistent starter. He said, when you're in base, you are basically in nickel. Nickel is the new base. You're playing in that 70% of the time, so you need a good nickel defender. With what teams are throwing out there as their slots, you could see tall wide receiver ones, you could see tight ends, you could see those shifty fast guys as well. So to have a stud slot player, a versatile slot player, guy who is very smart, very versatile, is super important. Then he also said that on their board, they take pride in knowing that the state of Georgia produces a lot of really great football players. Not just players who went to the University of Georgia, but players
right.
who are born in Georgia, played high school football in Georgia, and then maybe went somewhere else, probably around in the SEC. And he said, whenever there's a player from Georgia, we always put a little peach icon next to their name on the draft board. Not to necessarily say that that matters more than other things,
yeah,
but
just
to note. And I will say, there is one slot defender in this class who is very, very good, in Brian Branch,
mm-hmm.
who went to the University of Alabama, is the number one safety in this class, and guess where he's from? Fayetteville, Georgia. So, look, I'm not saying they're going to pick him at number 8 overall. All I'm saying is it's on the table.
Presenting some information and joining some dots.
It's
That's
on
all we're doing.
The table. The other one is Pete Carroll. Pete Carroll's podium was fascinating. Pete Carroll is just a fascinating individual.
Yeah.
I mean, you ask him one question, he'll give you a 5-6 minute heavily detailed answer. And the part that really stood out to me from him in a general standpoint is somebody asked him about multi-sport backgrounds and how much it might go into his scouting. And he said, it's the first thing that I ask
wow.
about a prospect. Did you grow up playing other sports? How long did you play basketball? What position did you play? Were you a slasher? Were you a point guard? Were you a power forward? Did you play baseball? Were you a center fielder? Were you a shortstop? Were you a first baseman? What did you play? How long did you play? Did you play well? And,
right.
and it's like, the Seahawks are going to be – I know a lot of teams like multi-sport athletes because
mm-hmm.
it shows how natural of an athlete you are. But apparently, for the Seahawks specifically, that is a team that will definitely prioritize. If any of these guys, if there was – man, these guys are neck and neck. We're not sure who to pick. If one of them played multi-sports growing up and one of them didn't, that's probably going to be the kid that they pick for how much he emphasized it and said it was critical
wow.
for their scouting.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
There are certain head coaches or GMs or whatever that clearly – I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but clearly get more out of these podium appearances than others who can't wait to get the hell out of there. You know
right.
what I mean? Like,
right.
I'm here for 10 minutes. There's a guy to my left who has got a stopwatch in this. As soon as he says time,
I'm out.
We're gone. And then there are other guys, like Sean Payton was holding court from his Denver.
Come on, he loved it.
That's what I mean.
He loved it.
He was all over it.
He came back for this.
Yes. The guy, the minder, was trying to wrap it up, and Sean Payton was like waving him away and going, No, we got more questions here. We got more questions to answer. We're going to keep going. Now, it took people like 10, 15 minutes to get around to asking about Russell Wilson, which is, you know, a different question. But
yeah.
He was engaged in that, you know, press appearance in a way a lot of these guys aren't. That's just a different level of kind of fun for this.
Yep.
I'm all for those kind of guys.
Oh, 100%.
Pete Carroll is the same kind of guy. Like, he somehow, at his age,
he loves it.
He still loves that.
He really does it. And, you know, I think Seahawks general manager John Schneider does as well. Like, he was, like, joking around with, and, like,
right.
Mike McDaniel's kind of the same way,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, Mike McDaniel's, like, joking around with all sorts of different, you know, questions and everything. Like, somebody asked him the Jordan Poyer question. He's like, well, I'm not in the business of tampering. And he kind of, like, looks at the person and just is like, you're trying to get me in trouble. But, I mean, he had a lot of really great creative answers. And that's been a lot of fun, right? Especially for general managers. We just don't get to talk to these guys very often. It's
right.
basically owners' meetings, when they hire a head coach, and I think at the end of the year. That's about it outside
also,
of Indianapolis.
McDaniel showed up with an evolution of the Andrew Whitworth suit jacket and
yeah.
hoodie combination.
Yeah.
He had actually fused them together
I know.
In one item of clothing.
It was impressive.
I've never seen that before.
I almost asked him where he got it from.
You should
have. I don't know if I could pull it off, though. That's the thing.
No, I mean, but I don't think you need to. You just need the information.
You just need to do it.
You need to at least have the option.
We know Dolphins people, though. So,
that's
I mean,
true.
We could figure it out.
That's true. We could put it together.
We could figure
yeah.
it out. Yeah.
We certainly need to find the answer for Andrew Whitworth. I mean,
that's the next step. And that's a custom.
It's
Andrew
the next
actually
step.
Follows me on Twitter. Flex.
Thanks. Yeah.
Flex, just for everybody out there.
I got a text from Andrew Whitworth.
Okay, that beats me.
Nah.
He doesn't know who I am, probably. That's tough.
Yeah.
You should ask him.
Yeah.
Next show, Sam's going to have Andrew Whitworth's exact
hoodie
suit combo.
I copied him on somebody tweeted out. It might have been the former Austin Gale over there. Former PFF Austin Gale.
Former.
Yeah, yeah.
Change his name. Change companies.
The late Austin Gale. He's dead
wow.
to us now.
Wow.
Might have been him that tweeted out the picture of it. And I CC'd Andrew Whitworth in it just so he had.
Of course.
Just so we made, you know, he knew.
Right.
Just we knew where to go.
Had to.
So we've only got half of this gone through. Who are you excited to hear from at the podiums over the next couple
Well,
of days?
I mean, like, quarterbacks are the biggest, right? And I think what I like to learn about quarterbacks is not only, of course, like, how they handle media. Because, let's face it, how quarterbacks handle media matters. I know you brought up, like, Justin Herbert.
Sure.
Like, some guys can be more quiet. Leaders don't have to necessarily like the limelight, like, being in the spotlight. But that is the job.
Mm.
Like that is part of your job. Even if you don't love it, even if you are more of a quiet person,
yep.
you also have to be okay with being more of a quiet person. So, like, all that definitely goes into
and,
it from quarterbacks.
And the criticism, which is going to come if you're like that. I mean, Justin Herbert
yeah.
has taken an unreasonable amount of crap
yes.
because he is the kind of person that he is. And if you're not really good, you know, to overcome that and
yeah.
it sort of goes away just by itself because you can't really criticize guys that are amazing.
Right.
If you're not that guy, you have to accept that you are going, and it's not a fair thing, but you're going to take more of that than other quarterbacks.
And, of course, like, the measurables too, you know. How big is Bryce Young? You know, like, how big is Quentin Johnston? How big is Jordan Addison? You know, like, all these guys where Devon Witherspoon's another player who I'm like, if Devon Witherspoon comes in a little bit bigger than we think that he's going to, like, that's a CB1, like, solidified. You know, and right now I think it's probably him and Christian Gonzalez from Oregon, and I think Christian Gonzalez is going to show up. He's going to be big. He's going to be tall. He's going to run fast. He's going to jump high. So we're kind of sorting out little rankings within tiers, if
right.
you will, with these measurables. And so that's just a lot of the stuff that I look forward to as well, actually getting those finalized, because we know some schools lie about it on their website. If that's you, you know I'm talking to you. Stop doing that. We're trying to do our job and have a good time.
I do think that hearing from those, you know, the top quarterbacks is going to be fascinating, because it's such a weird, diverse group this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's each one of them has something to be terrified about if you're drafting. Each one of them has something to fall in love with. Just hearing from those guys, you know, almost back to back to back is going to be really interesting just as a data point. Like, what kind of personality is this guy? How does he respond to the inevitable questions about the thing that's scary about his game or his size or whatever it is?
Yep.
That, I think, is going to be an interesting sort of set of interviews.
And I do think that maybe I'll be the one to ask some of these questions at the quarterback's podium, but like, I feel like we're now asking quarterbacks about how some of their interviews are going. Like, it was the Eagles last year who did the Papa shot, right?
Mm, I think. Yeah, yeah.
And like, the quarterbacks were like, yeah, I walked into the room and they just like threw me a little basketball and they're like, shoot. You know, like, you're coming to you're probably nervous as hell walking into an NFL interview and they just throw you a small basketball and they're just like, shoot it. Shoot. And so, I don't know. I just feel like learning little things like that of how teams, obviously, like, some teams take it too far, like we've seen in years past, but like, little fun ways like that to maybe get a guy to calm down or get him out of his shell a little bit, see how they react. Like, that's the playful things are fun to learn, even though we've unfortunately learned that sometimes they get a little bit weird.
Yeah, I mean, I think the entire process for teams at this point is designed to get them out of the script.
That's what they want.
They're so coached.
Right.
You know, they're
right,
so coached to go through these interviews now.
Yes.
They are doing anything humanly possible to get them off script and find out who they actually are, as opposed to how well did you memorize the 10 minutes that you're supposed to give.
Yeah, they do that at their workout facilities now. Yeah. You know, like, having a interview coach is like part of your training. You are not just getting more fit. You're not just getting faster. Like, you are getting coached on how to answer these questions. So you're right. It's a huge part of what a lot of these guys go through.
All right, we're going to be looking forward to plenty more of these interviews in the next couple of days. And next up, it's going to be me and Mike Renner. All right, Mike, we talked to Brand about free agency. We talked to Trevor about what he's been hearing at the podiums. Now it's time for you to come back on the show. Obviously, we touched on this a little bit with Trevor. The biggest story from today was the news that broke this morning about Jalen Carter, the defensive tackle from Georgia. Let me run through a little bit of information about what we know, and then we will talk about what it means. Report came out from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's. The Georgia defensive lineman Jalen Carter was present at the scene of a teammate's fatal car crash on January the 15th, drove away, and misled police about it afterwards. There was a Georgia staffer, Chandler LaCroix, was driving the car that crashed, and a Georgia offensive lineman, Devin Willock, was a passenger. Both died. Another football staffer and another football player were injured. Police questioned Carter about whether he was racing the other car, and Carter denied it. So this happened like 30 minutes, something like that, before he was due to be on a podium talking. Obviously, that didn't happen. This was the sort of talk of the entire combine. And then Jalen Carter released a statement himself saying, this morning I received a telephone call from the Athens, Georgia Police Department informing me that two misdemeanor warrants have been issued against me for reckless driving and racing. Numerous media reports have also circulated this morning containing inaccurate information concerning the tragic events of January the 15th. It is my intention to return to Athens to answer the misdemeanor charges against me and to make certain that the complete and accurate truth is presented. There's no question in my mind that when all of the facts are known, that I'll be fully exonerated of any criminal wrongdoing. So, this is obviously a pretty substantial bombshell to be dropped during the combine. A guy that is one of the top players in the entire draft, is arguably the best player, period, in the draft. Presumably a top five draft pick, and this gets dropped. What do you make of it? What are your initial reaction to the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's tragic, just scenario altogether. Like, that was my initial reaction, is that it's just an awful thing. And obviously for him to be involved in the way that he's allegedly involved is not good by any means, and will not, I think, will be reflected come draft day, whatever ends up happening with the criminal charges, whatever ends up happening to him in terms of like actually punishment by the law. I think you can pretty well say he's not going to be a top five pick anymore. But I do think there does come a point in the draft where you're weighing the fact that he will still play football. You know, even if he does go to jail, even if he gets a max sentence or whatever, he will still be on an NFL field at some point, and he is still a generational defensive tackle prospect, or in that realm of blue chip prospects that, you know, can't miss if he stays healthy and on a football field. So someone's going to pull the trigger, but I do think if you are the optics of a team drafting in the top five now, they're not going to be the team pulling that trigger.
It does become this horribly cynical risk-reward, cost-benefit analysis of, like, when is the PR acceptable enough that we can pull the trigger on this guy and get an incredibly talented football player? That's basically the question, I think, that most NFL teams are asking themselves right now. Yeah. Because I think the kind of the sad reality is I doubt many, if any, teams are taking this guy entirely off their board.
Oh, yeah. You'd be lying to yourself. You'd be living in a different world altogether if you said that teams weren't still excited to draft this guy. Like, you know, like that it still is a game that, you know, you make money when your team wins. And as a coach and as a GM, and this guy's going to help you win football games. We've seen far worse human beings grace the NFL football field literally last year. So, yeah.
One thing that is kind of wild about this does appear to have come as a shock to NFL teams. Like, this was not something that they knew about already. You know, they were comfortable with, they were fine with, they knew all the details, blah, blah, blah. And then it gets dropped and all of a sudden the public is finding out and that's where it becomes a bombshell. This seems to have taken NFL teams by surprise. He did the interviews already, I think. He was doing the medical when this all dropped. He was about to be on the podium. And then, obviously, things change, and now he's presumably hightailing it out of town back to Athens to, quote-unquote, clear his name and or otherwise, you know, submit to the arrest warrant.
I will say, that's like the, I don't want to say good part about this. No good part about this, but we have a month and a half to sort this through. We don't have to make sweeping declarations about what's going to happen on draft day right now.
And I think that, like, it immediately sort of conjures up, you know, your mind looks for comparisons, right? What like this has happened before? And the only things you can come up with are the Laramie Tunsil, you know, the gas mask video that dropped like just before the draft. When did that?
Draft
literally
night.
Like half an hour before the draft started, right?
Yeah.
And then the Lyle Collins thing, where all of a sudden he's a person of interest in a murder inquiry, right? And
Gearing Conley.
Again,
too,
and the Collins thing again was like right at the time of the draft, and all of a sudden this is a total shock to teams who have no idea what to do with that information, and he starts to fall, and then that gets even further complicated because he's like, beyond a certain point, don't draft me. I don't want to get picked. I'm going to pick my own destination and go where I want to go. It's different from those for a couple of reasons. Obviously, it's a very different thing that happened, right? Like it's a road traffic accident where a couple of people died, where he may have been involved in it and may have some kind of culpability to that. But also, as you said, the timing is very different. We're not talking about something dropping 24 hours before the draft or within 24 hours of the draft. Teams are going to have a lot of time to work through this, to find out what their version of the truth is, to find out how comfortable they are with all that, and then again, run that cost-benefit analysis of, right, this is what we're dealing with. Where is it acceptable to draft him?
Yeah. My brother texted me earlier today. He said, so Jalen Carter's a Cowboy. That's a team that would draft him. That is a team that would draft him.
Do you think that with that time to work with, right, we're March the 1st right now.
Yeah.
Do you think that's enough time that this, it's not like it goes away, but it gets resolved to the degree where he still ends up going top five?
Whew. No. Just because of the implications of what he's been involved in, street racing that resulted in the death of two people, you're not going to do it. I just don't think the team's going to do it.
But I think it's going to depend sort of what the plea bargain ends up being and what he actually cops to and what, you know what I mean? Like there's going to be a difference between the court of public opinion and the court that actually finds him guilty of anything.
Yeah, definitely. It's like the alleged whatever is happening, that these are misdemeanors and that he could max even only face a year in jail seems a little...
Yeah, $1,000 fine and a maximum of a year in jail for each indictment, I believe, is the max that a misdemeanor can carry in the state of Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, it seems a little gross that's like it for what actually occurred, but that's, you know, a different conversation altogether.
So... every mock that was just done since mock drafts have been starting for this year, all blown to hell. Do you think that changes in the top five?
To me, it more just changes the trade scenarios. Everyone was, or myself, was really painting number four overall as being a likely scenario. Down to the Colts for the Chicago Bears, as they've said they want, you know, trade offers. Number four doesn't get you, you know, it's not going to get you a Will Anderson now, and you're obviously probably not going to draft a Jalen Carter then now. So you're if you do trade out at number four, maybe you're out of kind of that realm of the blue chip prospects in this draft.
If you
class.
Assume that now Arizona is going to draft the edge rusher Will Anderson. As opposed to the interior guy at three, now if you're Chicago, getting to four doesn't guarantee you one of those two blue chip guys, you've no reason not to trade further down.
Yeah, so it's really truly that it's like either two, or they may even want to go down to like 9 or 11, because once you get that far down, Carolina, Tennessee, you're getting future firsts. And that might be what the Bears want from a team building standpoint, is to get that possible lottery ticket of a team who drafted 9 or 11 this year and starting a rookie quarterback next year. They may be drafting the top five.
I think
again.
Absolutely any trade Chicago takes has to involve a future first-round pick. But to me, it like, I wonder if it starts to get offers on the table that they weren't even entertaining before. Like, all of a sudden, Chicago is listening to offers from the Raiders, the Falcons, the Panthers, the, you know, whoever. Like, those offers are now on the table. Maybe Houston, at number two, can actually get to one, giving up 12 instead of... Like, they could end up with one.
That's
and
too much. It wouldn't take that much to get to number one. But I do think that
no, I don't mean packaging 2 and 12. I mean,
but with
keeping
number
12. Two,
okay,
and picking the first two.
Oh,
having the first two picks of the draft.
That's actually something I'd never thought
Has
of. That would be
before?
Sweet. First two picks of the draft. I want to say it did happen once. Why do I think that happened with like the Colts? Maybe not. Maybe I'm lying.
I think you're right, though. I think it might have happened before.
Yeah.
But that would be wild. Like, they could actually potentially get to one without having to cough up number two and get the best defensive player and the quarterback of their choice, given that Chicago might be that open to offers at this stage. That would be kind of wild.
That's interesting. Yeah, the Colts did have 1 and 2 in 1992.
Was that Rick Meyer? Was that that year? Or the Jeff George?
It was probably Jeff George,
Jeff
right?
Jeff George.
Yeah.
God, you had 1 and 2 and you end up with Jeff George. That's got to that would sting.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so we don't – I mean, obviously, we can only go so far with the Jalen Carter conversation. This thing broke this morning. It's kind of a moving conversation. He's going to go back to Georgia, try and clear his name. We'll see where that ends up with. You would assume it winds up being some kind of plea bargain to something that everybody agrees is mutually acceptable, and then NFL teams have got almost 2 months to figure out exactly what they want to make of this. But – it does completely shake up the top of the draft. It changes every mock draft that's been done from this point on. It potentially transforms the fortunes of several teams and therefore is going to be probably the biggest story that comes out of this combine, almost regardless of what happens from here on in.
Yeah, and I've been saying that, you know, the Bears, if they want to trade that number one overall pick, they got to do it before free agency. You got to do it before the QB carousel, because that's when you can entertain the most offers. So this really throws a wrench into those talks as well now. And they really have to, they're offering prices and where they're willing to go, it changes that calculus.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing we're going to talk about is we're getting closer and closer to the actual on-field workout portion of the combine. Yeah. Somehow there's a week of stuff here before that actually happens. But we're getting there. So what is one player that you're particularly excited to watch work out at each position? Let's start working through some guys.
Yeah. Quarterback.
Now, he's not working out. Half of them don't work out, right?
Not working out. True, like, Anthony Richardson's probably going to work out because he's a freak. And you want to, if you are, you show that. But you just watch tape and you know he's a freak. I don't need that. What I need to know is how much Bryce Young weighs. I need to know.
But you're not going to find that out this week.
You kind of are, though.
You're not.
I need some verified
height
weights.
You're going to get some fake number that's like 15 pounds heavier than he actually is.
I know. I just need to see it, though. But it's like quarterback. The combine means absolutely zero for the quarterback position.
Don't you think, in fact, forget the weight. Here, I'm going to pitch something to you. I don't even care what he weighs in anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I want is the photographs from the workout portion where he is standing near regular-sized quarterbacks.
Yeah.
That, to me, is going to be more instructive than whatever number he actually puts up on the scale. It's going to be when he's standing there in his sweatsuit, when he's not working out, and he's vaguely near Will Levis or Anthony Richardson, and you're like, oh, my God, we are talking about different humans, like different body type. This is not the same.
Yeah. Now, I don't think I need anything to know he's small. He's small. Like, he just flat out is. But putting a number to it to just historically contextualize is all I really want.
How interested are you in what kind of accuracy Anthony Richardson brings to the table? If he does the full thing, if he works out, if he throws and we are, like, scattershot accurate.
Yeah. So I think I said this yesterday. I said everyone knows he's inaccurate. Everyone knows, like, that's all he's probably focused on is his fundamentals, working to get better at that this whole, you know, 2 months since the season ended. So if he comes here and is inaccurate, people are like, that's who he was. I don't think that's going to hurt his stock. But if he comes here and it's like, oh, wow, look at how clean his footwork is. Look at how good his ball placement is. I think this can only improve Anthony Richardson's draft stock to come here and throw. And if he does, look, you know, flawless, shall we say. Yeah, I think that will actually matter to NFL evaluators because it's like a changing product. Like you're hoping he's fixing things that need to be fixed at the NFL level. And if he's fixing them quickly, that's a very good sign.
I might be misremembering, but I seem to remember when Cam Newton worked out, he was pretty scattershot. There was a lot of missing high, which is something he always did in the NFL as well. Mm-hmm. And it made obviously no difference whatsoever to the fact that he was going to be the number one overall pick and go well. So I'm kind of with you that I don't know that it matters if he shows issues that we already knew existed. It just doesn't look great when he's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to running back. What do we got there?
Running back, there's a lot. There's a lot of, like, speedsters in this draft class. Devon Achane, Keaton Mitchell, Tajay Spears. Like, those guys, if they go above 4.35, I'll be surprised by any of those guys. But the other one that I'm really excited is Sean Tucker from Syracuse, because I expect him to go below that 4.35 number that I just said, and he's going to do it at, like, 215 pounds. He has unique size-speed ability. Like, that is his selling point. So how rare is his size speed? Like, is he truly that fast? Because as a recruit, the story is he ran a 4.29 coming to Syracuse. And so if he has that still in the tank, that's difficult to pass up if he falls to day three, because size speed still is, you know, there's a reason why speed score is the most translatable sort of thing at the running back position, or is very indicative of future success. It's because the guys who can get through small holes with some mass behind them and not really get impacted by these arm tackles, those are the guys that produce at the NFL.
Is this the fastest running back group you can think of coming along for a long time? Because there's so many people I've seen reports of, like, he's going to run in the 4.2s.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And it's the fastest in terms of guys who are actually running backs. You know, sometimes you'll see some, you know, the Dree Archers of the world, the guys who are pure gadget guys. But everyone I just mentioned was a bell cow for their team last year. Had well over 200 carries, had well over 1,000 yards. Like, those are all guys who carry the load already, even if maybe some of them are smaller. So definitely an exciting running back class that will break a lot of ties here in Indy.
Right. What about wide receiver?
Wide receiver, there's two guys that really stand out that I, like, want to see. For vastly different reasons. One's Quinn Johnston, for just, like, the freakishness aspect. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to be the most impressive athlete here at the receiver position.
Yeah.
And truthfully, I think he can put up, like, an all-time combine at the wide receiver position. Just based off his tape, the guy's a freak. But then the other one's Jaxon Smith-Njigba, because
it's the other end of the scale.
The other end.
It's like, how not great is the 40?
How not great is the 40? Is his hamstring healed? And, like, the last time we saw him, he was a sophomore. He was, you know, 19 years old. He could physically develop. You know, we really didn't get to see him on a field this year. Like, he could get faster, and we just didn't get to see it. So, excited to see just what kind of athlete he is now after really a year off.
This entire wide receiver group to me is almost like, I want a number next to almost everybody for something, right? Like, you want Quentin Johnson from TCU's, like, his just overall athletic profile. You want to see just how small our guys, like Jordan Addison, Zay Flowers, you know, these guys, just what is JSN's 40 time. Like, it's the entire wide receiver group to me seems like each one of these guys, we know there's a question mark or something.
Mm-hmm.
We want the number. Like, the whole thing is like the Bryce Young conversation.
Yeah. And I've come around. I like this wide receiver class probably more than I did initially after the season, because I was looking for, like, you know, last year they were just like dudes. They were like guys who you knew were going to be good. This year I don't think there's really that many guys that I will go to bat for saying year one 800 yards is a minimum. I don't think that's the case, but I do think that there's a lot to work with, and I think you see at least four, if not five, wide receivers go in the first round still.
What about a tight end?
Tight end, it's Michael Mayer, for the same reason that we said about Jaxon Smith-Njigba. They are, like, very similar prospects, in my opinion, just at different positions, in that everyone knows they know how to play the position. Everyone agrees that they are going to be good NFL players. It's just how good. It's kind of the question, like, how much? And with Mayer, he's huge. You know, he's a massive tight end. He was carrying some weight that he probably didn't need to carry last year. It was up in the 265 range, which, you know, tight ends in the NFL nowadays, it's great for the inline blocking, sure. Like, that aspect is a big aspect of his game. But you can get by being 250 nowadays, and that's that's fine. Like, that's good. So maybe he, what is he weighing at? Is he going to trim down? Is he going to try to get faster? Because those are probably the only question marks about his tape, is just the how high end of an athlete is he.
He feels like a guy. We almost seem to be getting to this point where just well-rounded, good football players get crapped on because they don't necessarily have, like, an amazing calling card somewhere. Like, Dalton Kincaid looks like an amazing receiver and is just clearly better at that aspect than Michael Mayer is. But Mayer's a much more well-rounded player, and yet we gravitate towards the one thing that's that stands out as opposed to the overall package, which I think has to be seen as superior. It's kind of weird to me that that's... Because I think that was the case with Garrett Wilson last year. I think that's the case with Jordan Addison this year. Like, we focus on the thing, the one standout trait, as opposed to the composite.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the nature of first-round picks, though. You know, teams chase the highest events. Like, there's that, like, whole thing. If he's a top-five pick, he has to be all-pro potential.
Yeah.
And it's like, sometimes you just want to get a good football player. Yeah. You know? And so, like, if you're drafting Michael Mayer, you're drafting Jackson Smith and Jigba in the draft class, you have a win. Like, those guys,
like,
are good already.
It feels like either, yeah, either we're sort of misrepresenting what the strike rate is for these guys, you know, and chasing something that's just much less likely to happen than they think it is, or dramatically underestimating just how important a good player is. Like, if you get a guy who's maybe doesn't have a standout trait, but his composite skill set is good and he is a good player, that's a really valuable thing and probably worth a very high first-round draft pick.
Yeah, if you stack... And I say this all the time. You know, first, second, third round picks, that's kind of like your draft. If you hit on those three every single year for four straight years, you have 12 quality starters on your roster. You're a good football team. You have 12 quality starters on rookie deals.
On rookie deals, right.
You can get...
You have the best roster in the NFL.
You can get 10 more via free agency, via elsewhere, that you are a playoff team and a Super Bowl contender if you can just do that. You don't need... Yeah, you love high-end impact players. That's what you want, like, that obviously as a roster teams pay for those heavily, but if you just have no holes in your roster, you're going to be in the Super Bowl conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you if you have that kind of strike rate, you would be the best drafting team of all time, and you would have, by definition of what it allows you to do everywhere else, you would have probably the best roster in the league. And I think teams kind of lose sight of that trying to chase these, like, superstars. Like, I need the Jamar Chase. If I do that, that allows everything else to work. I don't think you do. You just need to actually draft well and probably this is a funny way where, like, Kwesi, you know, for the Vikings, is probably an interesting guy to monitor, because as a finance guy, it's all about diversifying the portfolio, making sure that you do get enough on the fairway, and not everything is shooting for that green and the hole in one, all that kind of stuff. All right, offensive line.
Yeah, and I was going to just to one more point on that. If you swing for those high ends, you force yourself into a position where you're starting them 3 years in a row. You know, like, a first-round pick who's a top 20 pick, top 15 pick, they are starting on your roster for three straight years, and good or bad, you're kind of shoehorned into them. And so you can have a hole on your roster drafting guys who are just these projects and not address it because you're, like, waiting for that next shoe to fall. All right, offensive tackle, though. DeJuan Jones is who I want to see test. I don't love this tackle class. Like, I don't really care what, you know, Broderick Jones, Peter Skoronski, Paris Johnson, they have the athletic tools to succeed. I can see that on tape. But DeJuan Jones is the one where it's like, he is a unique dude. And even if he tests poorly, I'm not super worried. But, like, if he tests kind of even just, like, as an average athlete, for a 6'8", 375-pounder.
Biggest wingspan ever.
Biggest wingspan ever, 7'5½" inches. That's a guy I'm taking in the first round. If he has average movement skills at that size, because he's so skilled for attack, like, uses his arm so well, that I'm taking him. Maybe he's not going to ever look like Trent Williams, but he's going to be a quality starter in the NFL if he truly is that.
How interested are you in Skoronski's arm length? Because that's the thing that a lot of people are going, as soon as he hits 32¼ or whatever, it's like, guard, forget it.
They're short. They are, you can tell. So they're shorter than 99% of starting tackles in the NFL. If it's, you know, comes in 31 inches or whatever, it's not what's going to come in at. Then it's like, okay, yeah, he's 100% kicking inside. But yeah, I guess I'm a little interested. If he gets over 32, I'm still trying him at tackle. Braden Smith's 32 range, fine tackle. That's, you can get by there, and it's obviously the value proposition. Dak's just more valuable, harder to find. I'd throw him there first.
The Joe Thomas ruined the whole arm length argument when it turned out that his like 32-inch measurement was fake.
Yeah.
Was some sort of error in the system, and he actually is like 35 and prototypical arm size for an offensive tackle. Now everybody's got to scramble around for the Braden Smiths of the world. It's like, it's not quite as compelling an argument as, you know, Joe Thomas has short arms, therefore you can put whoever you want there. What do we got? We got defensive line. That's where we're going next.
Defensive line. Let's go to Kalijah Kancey from Pittsburgh.
Yes.
The uniquest. It's not a word. You can't modify unique. He's the uniquest dude.
Here's the thing. Here, this is a total diversion. This is what we do on this podcast, right? Yeah. I am going to put an argument to you that you should be allowed to modify unique, right?
Okay.
Here's why, right? Every human being in the world is unique. Mm-hmm. Steve, however, is more unique than you or I.
Yeah. But then
he just is. He is unique, more unique. He is very unique.
He has more unique traits.
Yes. And therefore that's how you would have to. An extreme level of unique.
He has more of them.
It should be possible to modify unique to differentiate just how rare a certain thing is.
I mean, I agree, but it is itself a what is it called? Superlative. So
right.
But Kalijah Kancey is the uniquest of the dudes here. You don't find 6 foot 280 pound defensive tackles in the NFL. Full stop.
Who's your comp for him?
There is no comp for him.
Oh, you don't have one.
There's no comp. That's why you don't find 6 foot 280 tackles.
Well, you do.
Even Aaron Donald,
right?
Who is a little over 6 foot. I think he's taller than Kancey. He's a little bigger than Kancey, and he's 100% longer than Kancey. I think Aaron Donald had almost 33-inch arms. Kancey is not going to come in that size. So you go back and I went back and watched Aaron Donald tape at Pittsburgh because I wasn't scouting then.
Right.
When he came out, it was before we graded college football, and just to kind of watch the difference. And this is going to sound blasphemous to say, but like, I think Kancey is quicker than Aaron Donald. The gold standard for that, I think he is quicker.
Wow.
Based on his tape. At least the collegiate tape is quicker. Now, obviously, Aaron Donald in the NFL, a different animal, we were projecting years out. But I think he's quicker, but he's definitely not as powerful. Like, Aaron Donald, that's kind of the underrated thing of him. Yeah, he doesn't hold up well to double teams, but he is strong, man.
And
like, he gets his hands on you, and they are powerful. Kancey doesn't really have that to his game. Now, he can leverage you, he can get underneath you, and he can explode off the line of scrimmage, but he doesn't have that strength aspect that Aaron Donald has. But the quicks, there's going to be a role for him that he is going to be impactful for. Sure, he may be a liability against the run, may have to protect him in some regards, but that is a guy who's going to make an impact at the NFL.
That's fine. Yeah, so he's going to get a lot of comps to Aaron Donald just because of the easiness of undersized defensive tackle from Pittsburgh, right? It's just not fair to compare anybody to
Aaron
Donald.
Wild that it is from Pittsburgh, though, right?
Right.
Like,
wild that
the two ones are from Pittsburgh.
But it's not fair to compare anybody to Aaron Donald because he was dealing with two things, like the ridiculous undersized thing, but then having like maybe the best hands I've ever seen from an interior defensive lineman of shedding blocks and making like those two things together are why Aaron Donald is amazing. It doesn't work if you only have one of them, or it might, but it's a totally different conversation. So to me, it's like, you know, can he be the next Aaron Donald? It's just an unreasonable and ridiculous question. But if you start thinking about like what he can be. Like, can he be some sort of supercharged version of Milton Williams for the Eagles? That was a guy that they drafted. Now, he's an undersized defensive tackle, but he's like 3 inches taller and 10 pounds heavier, maybe. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's a very different sort of size scale we're talking about, but that's a more reasonable question.
Yeah. So, in Bruce Feldman's freaks list, Kancey was someone in the top 20. He said he ran in the 4.6s at that size. Aaron Donald, obviously, the DT record, ran 4.69 coming out. If he goes faster than Aaron Donald, I will. That's a guy I might go top 10 pick on. Truthfully, just because of how he has the best hand, he has the best pass rushing moveset in this draft class. Donald Carroll position, he's better than Jalen Carter, better than Will Anderson. Like, he has more moves at his disposal. He knows how to rush the passer. And if he's that high of an athlete, I don't care if he's 270. There's going to be a position along the defensive line where he can make an impact. And I'd even at that point, if he does come in really light, I'd even transition him out to the edge just because he's so good.
Wow.
Like, we've seen it with James Harrison. We've seen it with, like, an Elvis Dumervil. He can be in that mold of just a guy that's a problem as a undersized bull rusher off the edge.
Just take a guy at that size running that speed is absurd.
Yeah.
Like, having had some very recent experience discovering how fast you can run these days.
Yeah.
But, like, even I think the fastest I ever hit was like a really high 4.6, and I weighed 100 pounds less than he does. Like, that's ridiculous. He can run the same speed that I could when I was at my fastest, and I was fast, and he would be carrying an extra 100 pounds. Yeah. Like a 100-pound backpack chasing me down. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it just, his get off on tape is truly different. You know, it is. He is into offensive linemen before they can even get out of their stance. You know, and he times up the snap when he has, you know that part down. It's over. You're fighting for your life then as an offensive guard.
All right, linebacker.
The linebacker that I'm looking forward to seeing most in this draft class at the combine is Ivan Pace Jr. from Cincinnati. He is 5'10", 230. So we already know how big he is, and it's not big. but
it's like 230 is not insignificant when you're 5'10".
When you're 5'10", yeah. So like it's more like the wingspan. He's never going to, in coverage,
right,
be able to affect plays that, say, a Tremaine Edmonds can. Mm-hmm. So that's, he's going to have to play a specific role.
Like he's built like a tank. Like that's fire, like a brick.
He's a firehead. Yeah. But my lord, he is as quick a linebacker as I've seen come out of the draft. And he had the fastest GPS time at Senior Bowl of any linebacker the last 4 years. 20.58 miles per hour is cooking. Faster than all but four wide receivers there. Wow. This guy was. He is. You watch him rush the passer at that size, and it's like he's like Kalijah Kancey. He's the Kalijah Kancey of linebackers. just an unbelievable athlete, but just no build that you see on an NFL field today.
There was a guy a few years ago, I forget who it was, who was built in a similar kind of mold, like this 5'10", 5'11", but like 230, 240, like stocky, short, built like a brick and explosive in a straight line. I forget who it was, and I don't think he ended up becoming, well, obviously.
Is that Jatavis Martin? I think it was, right? He went to the Chargers? He was from Toledo? Jatavis?
I don't think so.
Maybe not, but... No. I will say, Malcolm Rodriguez is probably your case study. Last year, sixth-round pick to the Lions. Same knocks, right? Same, like, he was 5'11", wingspan is the shortest of any linebacker in the NFL. And I think his rookie year, like, you weren't upset having him out there as a linebacker. Like, the similar type of just, like, everything else is there except for the size. So maybe he's never going to look like Luke Kuechly at linebacker, never going to look like Fred Warner. But I think there's a role for a guy like Ivan Pace at the NFL level, and I'm just excited to see how high-end his athletic tools really are.
Okay, let's go cornerback.
Cornerback, it is one Keely Ringo from Georgia. Love this cornerback class. I think he's gotten passed up, though, by a lot of guys just because his tape was, quite honestly, lackluster this year. And it's not just the 40. Because I am excited to see the 40, because he could be in rarefied air based off of his. So he ran 4.35 electronically verified in high school. He has track times in the low 10 second range coming out of high school as well. But he's 6'2", 215. You know, he looks like a linebacker out right there. So if he goes sub 4.35 at over 210 pounds, he'll be the only cornerback in combine history to have done so at that size. Unique size speed dude, but I'm actually more looking forward to his cone and his shuttle, because that's where he doesn't win. That's where he loses. He is not the pure match and mirror guy. And so if those are ugly, I have a third round grade on Ringo right now. I just don't see how that can play at the NFL level with how stiff he kind of looks on tape at times.
And that's the downside of that size, right? Everyone's searching for that size, the length, the things that it lets you do down the field. But the flip side of that is that the problem with that is it does make it really hard for those guys to transition in space and break down and change direction and go laterally compared to much smaller guys or much quicker guys that they're trying to cover.
Yeah.
What about safety?
Safety, the guy I'm looking forward to most is Sidney Brown from Illinois. It was going to be J.L. Skinner. He tore his pec, not going to come here and test. But Sidney Brown from Illinois, because at Senior Bowl, he already checked it, weighed in, 5'10", not great, but he has a 6'3" wingspan, really long arms for a guy who's 5'10", and really big hands, 10 1/4" hands, which long arms, hands, I was like, that's tackling, that is the traits that help as a tackler at the next level. 213 pounds, uniquely built, like him and his brother is running back, are almost the damn near same size, so he has a running back build, but at the safety position, very curious to see what he runs here because he has some of the best GPS numbers of any safety in this draft class, and can really, really fly. So I think he's a guy who, after this combine, we could be talking about as, you know, a top five-ish safety in this draft class if he really blows it up.
All right, cool. Mike, that's it for us. We're going to kick it over to a little interview myself and Trevor did with Ron Rivera, who had some pretty interesting answers about quarterback, about everything that Washington is going to be doing this offseason. So we'll talk to you again tomorrow. All right, welcome in. We are joined by head coach of the Washington Commanders, Ron Rivera. Ron, you've been here 3 seconds and you're already improving our production line. You're streamlining. You're getting Quinn on the job. Things are working better.
Well, the numbers said he should have done that 3.2 seconds.
There it is. There it is. There it is.
We were just talking before we went live about how, you know, we're not responsible for our numbers sometimes. PFF numbers get weaponized by other people trying to make a point, and you were explaining how, look, it's information that's good to have.
It is information good to have, whether you like the numbers, agree or disagree. The truth of the matter is you use those numbers, and you use them whether you got to fix things or improve things or know that, hey, you're doing things the right way. You know, I have a little saying, I like to say, figures lie and liars figure. But the truth of the matter is we need those numbers. And so using them when we get them to our benefit, as far as I'm concerned, is important. And I do take advantage of them.
You guys made a big splash this offseason, getting Eric Bieniemy as your offensive coordinator, something I know that you're probably fired up about. And I just want to have you talk about the interview process with him, bringing him in, what your expectations are with him. And, you know, it was such a publicized thing of somebody who is so accomplished from what he was able to do in Kansas City. But what are you looking forward to with EB?
Well, I'm looking forward to those numbers.
There you go. There you go.
It was very positive. But, you know, to that point, yeah, absolutely. You know, he's had a lot of success. He's been involved with a lot of success. So right away, he has instant credibility with people. He walks into the room and he commands their attention. This is just some of the characters I really like of the way he handles himself. I'm looking forward to us changing, you know, some of the things that we did offensively, doing things differently in terms of getting the ball into our playmakers' hands so they can be more explosive, and just finding other ways to do things. And you know, I'm very familiar with the system he runs because it's very similar to the one that I had when I was involved with Andy Reid when I was on his team, on his staff in Philadelphia. You know, it's got a bit of that West Coast flair to it. You know, the idea is to get the ball out of the quarterback's hands quickly and into the playmaker's hands. And that's what I'm kind of excited about because I really do like who our playmakers are. You know, I think we have really good weapons at all the positions as far as tight end, running back, and wide receivers are concerned.
You had the injury to Carson Wentz last season, and then when everybody got healthy, it felt like you were kind of riding the hot hand a little bit at quarterback. Mm-hmm. What went into the decision? What was the determining factor in figuring out who was going to be the starter for the rest of the year?
Well, what happened for the most part was, you know, with Taylor playing the way he was, things were really rolling nicely. You know, and then he had a tough game against San Francisco. And Carson came in and did some really good things at the end of that game. And I thought, you know, now's the chance to see if he's back. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. Then going into the Dallas game, you know, my decision was, do I go back to Taylor or do I go ahead and give Sam Howell that opportunity? My initial thought was, nah, let's wait. You know, I'll play him a lot in the game a little bit later. But then the realization at some point, we got to find out if he can start. Why not now? So that's what we did, and that's why we did it. He came out, played really well, had a good game. We beat Dallas to end the season, you know, on a high. So going forward, you know, I now say he's going to be QB1 to begin with. You know, he's got to come out. He's got to earn the job. He's got to show us that he is more than capable. You know, we're going to try and find some real good competition for him in free agency. You know, Taylor's a free agent, but we like Taylor an awful lot. You know, and we've got to go ahead and make sure we check all the prospects that are out there.
So I was just going to say, a tough decision in season, obviously, juggling the quarterbacks, like you said, and then I'm sure another tough decision just to move on from Carson overall. And, you know, we've talked to some general managers and head coaches before that, you know, talk about knowing when to move on. Knowing when to make a tough decision is often what allows you to be the head coach, the decision maker that you need to be. So just how tough was that going into that, just moving on and just getting to a different point of where you guys are moving with the quarterback position?
Yeah, first of all, he's a stand-up guy. I don't think people realize or understand what type of a young man he is. He's the right kind of person. It was just very difficult just because of the way things kind of unfolded at the end of the year. And, you know, going forward, giving him an option to get out there before free agency starts so his people can work in finding him the next best fit for him to give him an opportunity to get back on track because he is a heck of a young man and a good football player.
You went viral at one point last season for this video of you telling Jeremy Reeves that he was making the Pro Bowl and his emotional reaction to that. It's so easy from the outside for everybody to kind of talk about players as just salaries or commodities or a roster spot or how much they're worth in trade collateral. How rewarding is like the people part of coaching that we rarely get to see, but is moments like that?
You know, other than winning and winning the Super Bowl, that's why you do it. You do it because you want to see guys have success. You want to help them get to achieve what they want. You know, and one of the things that Jeremy wanted to achieve was to make the 53, and he did that. One of the things you want to do for Jeremy is you want him to be able to play out on the field and have success, and that's what he did. And then you want to be able to have success as a team, and we've had some early on when we first got here, winning the division, you know, in 2020, and he was part of that. So all those things were great, you know, and I don't know if everybody knows the story, but, you know, he's a guy that was undrafted, gets cut from his original team. The Washington team picks him up, has him on practice squad. I come in, and he has a great camp, but he doesn't make the team. And so I said, listen, we want to put you on practice squad, and I promise you this. If we get down to it, I will activate you. So what happens was during the season, we lose two safeties, and so I bring him in, and we activate him, put him on the 53. And he says to me, oh, I thought you were going to bring one of your other guys in. I said, no, Jeremy, I gave you my word. I was going to stick to my word. And he looked at me and says, well, I appreciate that. So, and he goes out, and he plays well. Well, the next year, again, he gets cut, but we put him on the practice squad, and I tell him the same thing. I said, again, when we have to, I'm going to activate you, and you'll be one of our guys. Sure enough, he ends up playing for us, and we activated him. And the unfortunate thing happened was his mother passes suddenly and unexpectedly. And so when I bring him in to tell him, hey, look, you're the Pro Bowl special teams player, I knew it would be a huge thing for him, but I also knew it was going to be tough because – you know, he's the youngest son, and just, you know, his mom wasn't there to share that moment. That's why I told him. I said, I knew she would be proud, though, I promise you that. And that was a really cool moment. It really was.
Yeah, I mean, he played really well last year. Yes. He was on our all-pro team for the special team stuff as well.
And that's really kind of cool because, you know, it's accumulation of everything coming together all at once. And that's a young man who wanted to live his dream, who competed, never quit, and did the things the right way, and he's a young man that, you know, we most certainly want to have as part of our football team going forward.
I know the offseason is still kind of young right now, but, you know, with you going through the process of hiring EB to be the offense coordinator, then, like you mentioned, like Sam obviously being the guy for now going into the offseason, I'm curious what that process is like going through an offseason where you do have a quarterback available, but like you said, like, you know, if you can bring other people in for competition or things like that, you'll probably do so. Was Sam somebody that you talked about with EB when you were going through the interview process? And then what is kind of you guys' thought process towards potential additions the rest of the way?
What I did was I talked to every one of our coordinator candidates about him specifically.
Okay.
Just so everybody knew how we saw him, how we feel about him, and that we think he has the opportunity, the chance, and the ability to be the starting quarterback. But we weren't giving him anything. And so one of the things we talked about, too, was once we've done that, we've got to make sure we go out and find competition, veteran competition, guys that's going to come in and compete and push him, and maybe, who knows, maybe win the job, but at the same time, be there to compete. And if he doesn't get it, we got to believe this guy enough is going to go out. And then what he's going to do is he's going to accept, you know, the situation that he is the backup. And that's what you're going to have to do. Now, again, I'm not precluding this guy the opportunity, if he does come in, whether it be Taylor or somebody else, that they can win that job.
Did any of those candidates have strong takes on Sam Howell? Because we're talking about really small sample size guy. You know, college was a very sort of unusual offense. What was some of the stuff you heard?
But what I would have liked to have seen is how you guys felt about him if he had come out the year before.
Right. He was our number one quarterback
correct.
That time.
Thank you. And that's one of the things that we fall back on, not just myself and our staff, but our scouting department. Because when you go back and you look at the reports that were written about him, coming out of the 2020 season, you would say, dang, dude, could have been a first-round pick if he'd come out early.
Yeah.
So we looked at that, and we took that into consideration. And so when we went into the draft last year, you know, we're sitting there looking at all these numbers, all these things about him. We kept saying, well, there's no way he's going to be there in the third round. Well, we go through and we fill our first three needs with our first three draft picks, and we felt very good about those guys. We get into fourth round, and we had – made a move and we got an extra pick, and we're sitting there going, but we really like Percy. So we drafted him, and now we're sitting there and we're going, in the fifth round, and who's sitting there with the first pick in the fifth round but Sam? And so that's why we jumped on it, because we really truly believe that is a value pick. And so we pulled the trigger.
What do you want to see from Chase Young this upcoming season?
I want to see that confidence back in his leg. I mean, you know, he struggled getting through it, got himself into position, and really was tentative until the last, till we played Dallas. He really was kind of tentative, but he kind of just cut it loose, and you started to see that flare back. And that's what you want, because the dude's a natural leader. He brings energy to your defense and what you do and to your team. So I want to see that young man that came in as a rookie and just played ball hard. And didn't think, just reacted and played the game that he's capable of.
You talked a little bit about veteran options potentially coming in at quarterback. It feels like Washington has been really unlucky with the veteran quarterbacks that they've tried to put in there the last couple of years, whether it's Ryan Fitzpatrick, who'd had a few years of, you know, pretty good play up until then, mm-hmm. gets hurt almost immediately. Carson Wentz gets hurt, doesn't quite work out. Taylor Heinicke showed that he can go toe-to-toe with Tom Brady in a playoff game. And that doesn't quite work out.
Well, and then Alex Smith.
Right,
probably
Alex Smith.
Being, you know, one of the most tragic ones, because here's a guy that's at the peak of his career, you know, gets a chance to come in here. They got a winning record. They're going for it. And he, unfortunately, has that
right.
that catastrophic injury to his leg. And here's a guy that when we did give him the opportunity to come out and help us, and he did. He played well, gave us a chance to get into playoffs and got us into the playoffs. You know, but yet that leg was what it is, and it's so unfortunate. Yeah, we've had some tough times, and we'd like to hope and think that, you know, here's a blue-collar kid. He's got the ability. If we can keep him healthy, keep him upright, protect him, which we know is one of our priorities, he can get the ball, we believe, spread and distributed.
But does that history make you guys – does it change the thought process where we've been burned by this type mm-hmm. of thing so many times before? We're going to go and look in a different direction. We're going to do something different because mm-hmm. – this should have worked and didn't, so let's adjust.
Well, the hard part, though, is this is about injuries more so than it was about just not being good enough. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
You want guys that can come in and stay healthy, and that's what we hope for, because, again, this was about guys that did get hurt. You know, they draft RG3, who's looking like he's going to have a tremendous career, and all of a sudden he gets hurt. And you just it sets a franchise back. When your number one pick, your quarterback, gets hurt like that, it did. It set us back, and it's something we've had to work from and work up out from the muck. And now we're in position, I think, that we got our head above water. Now if we can sustain it, if we can put the people around him to protect him, I think our quarterback has a chance.
Well, we're excited about a lot of things. We're excited about Bieniemy's era with you guys. We're excited to see what we see from Sam Howell. We're excited to give you the numbers that will hopefully help you guys as well in the offseason. So, Ron Rivera, appreciate you joining us.
That was a shameless plug for numbers. No, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. It's always good to be with you.